This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Matthew Brzezinski, has been writing about Homeland Security for nearly 3 years. He's concluded that the Department of Homeland Security has been crippled by a lack of funding and political support. Brzezinski is the author of the new book, Fortress America. He also wrote the cover story of the current edition of Mother Jones, in which he makes the case that Homeland Security has taken second place to the Bush administration's obsession with Iraq. The Department of Homeland Security is composed of 22 formerly separate federal agencies. It has 186,200 employees and a budget of about $27 billion. The money goes to screening airline passengers, inspecting trucks and shipping containers, making arrests and drug seizures, reviewing intelligence reports, watching over 8,000 federal facilities, ports, power plants, tunnels, and bridges, and more. The department was billed as the most ambitious government overhaul since the creation of the Pentagon. But when Brzezinski paid a visit to its headquarters at the Nebraska Avenue complex of the Washington Naval District, he could barely even find it. He was expecting to find a colossus. He could barely find the building at all. He finally found the entrance at the end of a little alley. I asked him how he interpreted the unimpressive headquarters.
Well, I mean, I think it told me that it's a bit of a game of smoke and mirrors, that there's clearly a reluctance to start this department, that it's sort of a child of political expediency, where a great many people in Congress wanted it. The public was, you know, clamoring for the government to be seen as though it was doing something to protect the American people. And I think the White House was rather reluctant to unleash this sort of a monster. I mean, for perhaps ideological reasons, they're against, you know, big government, and this is clearly an example of big government. And also for very practical reasons, if you create an agency this size, you have to give up oversight to Congress. Whereas if you keep it within the White House as just a sort of a policy unit, which is what it was before, you can do a lot of things very quietly on the sly and without a great deal of oversight and scrutiny from outside political forces. So, I mean, it's a bit of the sort of very cynical political game that's played in Washington, that, you know, that you can at the same time be the largest government agency in the United States and at once also, you know, have your head office, which literally looks like, I don't know, the janitorial department of a junior college. It's frightening.
You've reached the conclusion that Homeland Security is very inadequately funded. What are some of the areas that you think are most in need of more money in order to protect us?
I think that airline security, for instance, we've done a reasonably good job of making sure that nobody with box cutters is going to walk on a plane again. However, while we make a big show of patting down little old ladies and even kids, and we could be sitting on a bomb, because the behind the scenes, which is screening the baggage and things like that, which are far less visible to the general public, just hasn't seemed to capture the imagination of the government as much. And we would roughly need around $3 billion to hire, it's in the neighborhood of 20-odd thousand baggage screeners and of course, buy the sort of EDS, larger-type EDS screening machines that could screen all this baggage. And there is no money for this, and there's very little political will to get a program like this off the ground. So that's clearly one area. Screening for weapons of mass destruction at ports, major ports of entry, both land and sea. Purchasing of detection equipment for such as anti-radiation screening materials and things like that. Purchasing equipment, particularly radios, for first responders. Right now, first responders can't even talk to each other because they're not on the same frequencies. And we saw in 9/11, of course, that could lead to unnecessary loss of life. And so this is a very large area. They're extremely underfunded, and they're looking at budget cuts, in fact. In terms of biological and chemical responses, I think we need greater money to be sunk into detection equipment. The FBI is extremely underfunded as well, and its counterterror operations. In fact, they requested an extra $12 million to hire some counter a terror analyst and were turned down because there's just so little money. So it really runs the gamut.
In your Mother Jones cover story, you have a chart you put together where you compare the spending needs of Homeland Security with the amount of money that we're spending in Iraq. Do you want to describe what you've done in this chart, how you've compared the two?
Well, I mean, all told, we're spending about, so far at least, and the meter's still running, about $150 billion in Iraq. And there is extremely little money left over in the kitty for us to spend shoring up our defenses here at home. So we looked at sort of, you know, what would be needed to properly secure certain areas, everything from trains and subways, which the estimate is $6 billion. And that's about equivalent of about 20 days spending in Iraq, and what we've actually spent, which is about $100 million, which is 8 hours of we spend that in 8 hours in Iraq. Things like radiation portals, we need just under $300 million, which is very, very little money for a country this size, and we spend that in less than a day in Iraq. And in fact, we've spent only $43 million. Which is about we go through that and burn through that in about 3 hours in Iraq.
Radiation portals are to check for
For weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. dirty bombs, nuclear grade materials that might be smuggled into ports, and so on and so forth. Yes, everything from firefighters, as we said, that's really the biggie, $36 billion, which is 120 days worth of Iraqi occupation. And we've only allotted $500 million, which we spend in Iraq in less than 2 days. So emergency medical training is we need $1.4 billion, and we've only allotted, well, we've actually chopped that to nothing, but we had only allotted $50 million, which we go through in a few hours in Iraq. And it just seems that, you know, that really all the resources are being diverted abroad, and there's very, very little left over for us to properly secure ourselves here at home.
Could you say with any certainty that if we weren't spending that $150 billion on the war in Iraq, that we would instead be spending that on Homeland Security? Would the money still not exist for Homeland Security, even if we weren't spending it in Iraq?
That's a very good question. I can't tell you what the administration would ultimately allot. However, given the dire sort of financial straits of the budget right now, it basically makes it a lot easier for them to say, no, we just don't have the money to spend on a lot of these things. I think, you know, if we weren't in Iraq, there'd be a lot more money available, and we'd definitely be much more likely to spend more, perhaps not as much as everyone would like, but certainly more than we're spending right now.
I'm sure people who support the war in Iraq would say, well, the money for Homeland Security is perhaps less necessary because we're taking care of some of the problem by being in Iraq, and in the long run, that will make Homeland Security less of a problem because it is helping to win the war on terrorism.
Well, I'd have to disagree. There's so far there's been very little evidence that going into Iraq had anything to do with the war on terror, and there is, however, a great deal of evidence that by going into Iraq, by essentially invading an oil-rich Arab country, we have done great harm to our reputation abroad, particularly in the Muslim world, and we've done a great service to Osama bin Laden. And public opinion poll after public opinion poll has shown that America's standing in that part of the world has just plummeted, and this, of course, means that there's a greater potential pool of recruits for Al-Qaeda out there. And I think there is clear evidence that more people today want to do us harm than immediately right after 9/11 or before 9/11. So we are at a greater danger today than we were before we went into Iraq. And we've left ourselves, we've left a soft underbelly to our shield is the one here on the front lines at home.
Now, another financial comparison you make is that the FBI's entire 2005 budget is less than a third of the value of Halliburton's $17 billion contracts to rebuild the Iraqi infrastructure. How do you interpret that?
This again is something that, you know, how do you place a premium or a value on the priorities of the White House? And clearly, you know, in Washington, one of the ways that different government agencies establish the pecking order and put them, you know, determine where they fall on the totem pole is by how much money they receive. And I think it's rather tragic that the FBI, which is, you know, one of our frontline agencies in terms of protecting ourselves, is getting only a fraction of what Halliburton and all its subsidiaries are getting to provide Iraqis with subsidized gas and $30 hamburgers for our own troops and things like that. And in at a time of scarce resources, I'm not sure that that's the wisest allocation of resources.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Matthew Brzezinski, and his new book is called Fortress America. It's about homeland security. The federal government is giving cities money to help them deal with homeland security. What is the system? What is the equation for dividing up that money?
Well, there really isn't one, unfortunately, in terms of one that makes sense.
I said cities. I should have said states.
It could be cities and states, but it's basically on a population basis. And this is one of the great criticisms that's been leveled against the Department of Homeland Security, is that, you know, here we are, you know, now well into, they've been in business since March of last year, so a year and a half they've been operating, and there's still no list of sort of priorities, which might indicate that, hey, New York City and Washington should be higher up on the list of potential targets than, you know, Des Moines, Iowa, or Juneau, Alaska. And yet, if you look at it, you know, on as things break down, those places are getting more money from Washington.
Let me quote a couple of statistics that you've given. Alaska and North Dakota get twice as much federal anti-terror funding per capita as New York. Wyoming gets four times more funding per capita than California. What's the explanation for those figures?
There really isn't much of a logical explanation, and it's just that everybody has to, you know, they're divvying up the pot, and they're trying to be, I guess, democratic about it, that everybody has to get a slice of this. And of course, there's the lobbying that comes into play. Where the local congressmen and senators are like, well, we need our slice of the homeland security pie. And it's just like military spending, where the contracts have to be broken up into all kinds of different states. But it, in terms of the logic, it makes very little sense. The only, say, piece of infrastructure in Alaska that is a danger, is of course the pipeline and the oil terminals, and we should protect those. And in fact, we should force the oil companies to pay for that, because after all, it is their own. This is private property, and they're the ones who are ultimately going to pay if the terrorists blow it up. So there's really no reason to be spending a lot of money, on Juneau per se. That there's no targets there, and same thing, you know, in places like Wyoming and whatnot. So very little of it makes sense, and it's just the way that, you know, the world works in Washington, and partly because of lobbying.
Now, in your book, you describe a terrorist plan by two plotters that was uncovered in Manila back in 1995, and their files were almost a blueprint for the September 11th attacks. What led the authorities in the Philippines to this plot?
It's an astonishing story, actually, something that could make a script for a movie. There was one evening in a sort of a downtown police station in Manila. There was a sort of a very charismatic, stubborn policewoman who was the watch commander. And around 11:30 at night or something, they got a call that there was some smoke coming out of one of the nearby apartment buildings. And so she dispatched an officer to go check it out. And he came back and he said, well, you know, it's just some Pakistanis playing with firecrackers. And he was ready to leave it at that. But being stubborn as she is, she kind of thought that, that sounds a little suspicious. So she actually personally went to check it out. And to make a long story short, there was a foot chase, shots were fired, and she arrested One of the conspirers, the co-conspirers of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and almost caught the mastermind, Ramzi Youssef, of the 1993 WTC bombing. And in all the computers and the files that they discovered in this apartment were blueprints, literally, for a plan that looked that in hindsight looked very much like the sort of genesis where they got the idea for 9/11. And even under interrogation, one of the culprits that she had caught already in 1995, he had gone to the United States and trained to be a pilot and had gotten his pilot's license in North Carolina, I think it is. And he had said, well, the only thing right now, the problem we have right now, we want to crash these planes in the buildings, but we don't know. The problem we have right now is we don't have enough trained pilots. And later, when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which is one of who was captured last year, one of the key 9/11 planners, admitted under interrogation that in fact he'd gone to Manila and talked to Murad and Ramzi Youssef, and this who was his nephew, and this was in fact the sort of where they got the idea for 9/11. And the interesting part of that story, of course, is that the FBI and the CIA were brought in by the Filipino police and military on these interrogations. They were given the transcripts of these interrogations. They were given access to the computers and the encrypted files on these computers. And so they knew as far back as 1995 that there was some sort of plan afoot to train pilots. And at that time, they were saying they were going to fill Cessnas with dynamite and crash them into things like CIA headquarters and possibly and Congress and possibly some tall, quote, tall buildings. But the plans were sort of very loose at that point. But still, the American intelligence was apprised of this and knew about it and sort of, you know, filed it and forgot about it. And so when following 9/11, this, you know, we were told, well, this was really out of the blue. There was no way to predict this, you know, September 11th and this sort of attack. That's not entirely true. Their signs went back as far as the mid-1990s.
You talked to the inspector who went to the site of this little explosion that led to the discovery of these files and of the people behind this plan. What did she tell you about her frustrations, knowing that the Philippine authorities had passed all this information on to American authorities back in the mid-90s?
She put it hubris. That they didn't want to listen to us. That we're just, you know, this is big, big, great America, and we're just a little Filipinos, third world country, and they didn't want to listen to us. And she felt, you know, frustration. She felt anger. This was clearly for her, in terms of her career. This was the highlight of her career. This was, you know, and breaking up this plot, which at the time also sought to this the chemical that the explosion they were making a sort of a nitroglycerin type of derivative bomb that was undetectable by the screening equipment at the time, and they had planned on putting it on 11 airliners, U.S. airliners, to detonate at the same time over the Pacific, so you would have had thousands and thousands of people dead, and so, you know, she had saved all these people's lives. And you know, clearly she was extraordinarily proud of this. And then she turned on her television and saw 9/11 and said, "Oh my God! It's this operation was called Bojinka. It's Bojinka." They, you know, and so there was indignation, there was frustration, anger. So all her efforts, she felt, were maybe in the end for naught, and nobody listened to her.
You've concluded that the Department of Homeland Security has been treated like a political football, that it's underfunded, and that, you know, we're spending proportionally too much on Iraq and not nearly enough on Homeland Security. Other people would say, you know, people who support the Bush administration's approach would say, look, bottom line, there hasn't been a terrorist attack within the borders of the United States since September 11th, so they must be doing something right.
Not necessarily at all. I mean, I think, of course, they have made a lot of progress and they have done some things right. There's no question about that. But just because this is very dangerous and this is where, you know, this is where efforts wane and we start resting on our laurels, congratulating ourselves that there hasn't been an attack. Well, 9/11 took really, if the genesis was 98, was 1995, and then they sort of seriously in earnest started really working on it in 98, you know, that took years. Terrorist operations take years to plan.
Well, Matthew Brzezinski, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Matthew Brzezinski is the author of the new book, Fortress America. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine.